Good morning and welcome to the Sundance Reel on the Weekends. I am sitting in with Rick Bruff here at KPCW. I'm John Burdick.
Good. Yes, I'm Rick Bruff, and here with John, one of the hardest working men in showbiz.
Yeah, in KPCW land at least. And we are going to kick off today's Sundance Reel on the Weekends with The Queen of Hearts is the name of the film. Our director, May2K, is in the studio with us, along with the lead actress from the film. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Welcome. An amazing film. It is it's a woman jeopardizes her career and her family when she seduces her teenage stepson and is forced to make an irreversible decision with fatal consequences. That's Queen of Hearts. Anne is here. I should introduce you. Very famous actress coming over here. Have you been to Utah before?
Yeah, I've been to Utah actually, but not to the festival here. This is my first time at Sundance.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Is it everything you hoped it would be?
It's more. we're having such a great time. It's beautiful here. People are so friendly and interested in the film. And we had a great screening last night and a great Q&A. And they just kept on asking good questions. And so we're very happy. Mm. We're trying to play cool all the time, you know, like we're stars, we're like cool. But we're just walking around with a big smile on our face all the time.
Of course. So you premiered last night at Prospector, right? And then it's playing down in Salt Lake today. And then Monday it's up here again at Park Avenue Theaters at 8:45 at night. And then Friday the 1st at the Park City Library. And then Saturday the 2nd. At Holiday Village. So, Queen of Hearts.
Yeah. May, I must confess, I haven't been able to see the film yet. But when you read a description about a character lives in a modernist-looking home, maintaining a perfect life in a Sundance movie, that's always a bad sign. Uh-oh, what's going to happen? So talk a little more about the setup for this character and sort of what she gets into.
Yeah. So it's a story about this woman that seduces her stepson, and she's happily married to a doctor, and she has two children. And they live like an upper class life, and then the son of her husband moves in with them, and the father of the boy he's 17 and he has difficulties connecting with his child, but his wife has experience in this field because she works with young people, young troubled kids in her work.
She's a lawyer
and specializing in family law. And so she connects with him, and they become friends, and that evolves into a sexual relationship. And the film is basically about two people that the character Trine plays is a woman has a longing to be seen, and that's the same with the boy, with the 17-year-old boy, that he also has a need and wants to be seen, and they connect in that sense and find a companion. So that's like the storyline of the film.
What I noticed about the connection that you set up between the two actors is that she, it seems to be going through a midlife crisis of her own, and this boy kind of brings her back to life, is what it seems like in the film. I didn't get to see it.
Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit about this taking on this role of a midlife crisis of a woman versus, you know, what you normally see in American films is men having midlife crises and going and buying a car and dating somebody that's like half their age, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So you kind of play on that here, I think, a little bit. Can you talk on that?
Yeah, so I was very interested in doing a movie where we kind of reverse the perspective. And also, not only the midlife crisis part, but also the part where, like, we know what to think of. If this was a film about a stepfather and a stepdaughter, you wouldn't hesitate to judge you wouldn't know what to think of that, and or at least I feel that I feel that that's wrong, and it's not difficult for me to find it in myself to think it's wrong, but when it's a woman and a younger man, the perspective of that becomes more, it's more difficult, it's more gray, whereas the stepfather stepdaughter is more black and white. And so I wanted to explore that with this film, and to play with the audience's expectations and their hope and their fears throughout the film, because it's more difficult to navigate these waters than if it's a stepfather and a stepdaughter.
Right. And I noticed you also echo it in the filming of it. I mean, you use a lot of the tones that you're talking about right now with just the shots themselves and the cool coloring that you used and just kind of a dreary kind of outlook to it. And I thought that was it was a good way to reflect that same angst, I guess.
Yeah.
And also another question I was thinking about when I saw this film was, can you talk a little bit about the lawyer character and what she gets to do and how she is helping these kids, but then is completely blind to what she's doing to her own stepson?
Yeah, well, it is basically also a story about a woman that doesn't live up to her own ideals. And she really helps these young kids, and I think she really is an idealistic person, but also she had something in her childhood herself that she can recognize in a way, and maybe that's also one of the reasons why she kind of reproduces
a cycle of abuse.
Exactly.
Is the way I kind of said it. Yeah,
it's not very concrete, but it's there as a tone in the character. I mean, this character is very complex, and that's what makes it interesting, because it becomes a human being on screen, and it's not easy to like her or not like her, or you have doubt all the time. What is she doing now? And I understand her, but not really. And I mean, that was, we have tried to work on to make it as complex as life is.
Yeah.
Latrina, being well known in your own country as an actress, in terms of what audiences there know you for, is this role somewhat consistent with what they've seen you do before, or would they?
There are some scenes they haven't seen before. Yeah. Let's put it that way. Of course, this film also have some quite demanding sex scenes, but I just have to say that it's very explicit in the film, and there is a reason for that. It's character driven in a way, and we wanted the audience to be witnesses. But when we did it, it was very good taken care of, so nobody was hurt or anything when we did it.
No actors were harmed in the filming of the set.
That's always very difficult when you have to do intimate scenes, and Mai is such a great director, and she storyboarded the whole thing with the DOP, and we talked it all through, and you know, everything was taken good care of. But yes, this part is also, I mean, the way that she, I can't give it away. Yeah. but there are sides of this character that I guess that the audience that have seen my work doesn't know of.
As far as building this character, I mean, can you talk a little bit about your process of how you went out to make this such a real character? I mean, you completely identify with the struggles that this woman is going through throughout the whole film, and convey beautifully on film, and really bring the audience along for that struggle. So can you talk about how you built this character?
Yeah, I was invited in at an early stage, so I was part of, not the writing at all, but I was part of the developing of the character at an early stage, and then we rehearsed a lot, and then when we shoot, I like, and might also like, to explore and not to know. And if you know, now she's angry, you know, that's kind of boring acting. But if you know that, how is she thinking now? Then you open up things and it can be a little more nuanced. And the most important thing is to invite the audience into the inner chaos of the character so they can understand what she's struggling with and not... Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I think we're going to roll on here. But if you have seen it, it's The Queen of Hearts. It's playing today at 8:45 at the Tower Theater down in Salt Lake City, Monday 28th at 8:45 Park Avenue, the 1st at the Library Center Theater at night, 8:45, and Saturday the 2nd at 9:45 at HVC4. Holiday Village Cinemas. Thank you, ladies, so much. Enjoy
Thank
Sundance.
You,
Thank,
Thank
you
yeah.
for having
yeah.
us.
It's a great location.
Hi, I'm Jessica Pyra with Heber Valley Hospital. We are a nonprofit hospital and proud supporter of KPCW. Here along the Wasatch Back, we have top-notch OBGYN services available at Intermountain Park City and Heber Valley Hospitals. We have a nurse practitioner, a specialist whose training has brought a higher level of care to our community. Don't worry about driving to the city for appointments and birth. It's a shorter drive here. Intermountain Park City and Heber Valley Hospitals, healing for life.
And we're back. Welcome to Sundance on the Weekend, the Sundance Reel. I'm Rick Bruff here with my co-host, John Burdick. And now we have a film from an old friend of Sundance. The film is called Miles Davis, The Birth of Cool. And the director is Stanley Nelson, who is a Sundance veteran. I mean, how many times have you been here with a film?
This is the 10th time, believe it or not. Yeah.
Yes.
Starting all the way back with the Black Press in 1999, is that right?
Yeah, this is the 20th anniversary. Actually, today is actually the 20th anniversary of our premiere in 1999.
Oh, so in addition to his other skills, Stanley can also tell you how to dress for Sundance.
Dress warm. That's about it.
Yeah, you guys always bring snow with you, so we as parkites are really happy that Sundance always brings snow, and then everybody tries to walk around in it in the wrong clothing. But the first question, Miles Davis, The Birth of Cool. The hardest thing must have been putting the soundtrack together. I mean, it's. Can you talk a little bit about how that process even? How do you pare down all this great work to the soundtrack?
Right. In some ways, that was the best part of it. You know, that I've been listening to Miles for the last 2 years, which is fine. You know, one of the things we wanted to do was make sure that we kind of covered the different periods of Miles, because so many times people concentrate on the kind of blue Sketches of Spain era. You know, that end of 50s, and we wanted to really, you know, not only talk about that, but talk about what's called the second quintet, the Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter group. And we also wanted to talk about Miles in the 70s and 80s use some of that music. So we knew we wanted to cover all these eras. And we knew that, look, you know, we only can pick one or two songs. So what are the songs we're going to pick? And sometimes it was dictated by if we had an actual performance that we could use, that helped. And sometimes it was just the mood of the song.
Sure. I noticed, I think, one of the first footages that you used in the film, the first time actually Miles comes to life rather than just to the stills, was in the Kind of Blue session. Is that correct?
That's the first time we actually see Miles play. There's an incredible tape of Miles' group performing at on NBC, I believe it is. And you know, in those days, you know, they gave music performance on TV. They really put a lot into it. So it's just an incredibly filmed performance, you know, with three or four cameras, and it's really beautiful. It's live too.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fun to just watch that play in with all the still. So it's all of a sudden Miles comes to life right there when that such a quintessential part of jazz comes to life. You know, I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great little clip, and you know, it's Miles with John Coltrane, and you know, he gives John Coltrane a solo, and it's just a great clip.
I think the Sundance people were talking about their profiles of people and saying we're not doing hagiographies here, not simple-minded glorification. So, for the does this film look into you know, other dimensions of Miles or other dimensions maybe we didn't know about?
Well, you know, Miles was a difficult character, and you know, I mean, that I don't know, you know, if you don't know anything about Miles, you might not know that. If you know a bit about Miles, you probably do. He was difficult, and he was difficult with everybody. He was especially difficult with the women that he was with, and the women that he loved. I mean, I truly believe that he loved them, but he was just a difficult man. And so we try to make sure that's said, and that you understand that was part of him. One thing that someone says, which I thought was great, is that you know that one thing that his music did was allowed him to show another side of himself. And so, you know, because the question always comes up, how can somebody who was so argumentative and brutal, you know, play such beautiful music? And one of the people we talked to says, well, you know, it allowed him to show a different side in the music that he felt he couldn't show in the real world.
How do you deal with this cliche of the jazz musician has an addiction problem, and this feeds his art, or it inhibits his art, or whatever, you know, that old trope?
Yeah, I mean, Miles Davis, you know, went through different periods in his life, not only in his music, but in, you know, who he was as a person. And we go pretty deeply into his heroin addiction in the early 50s. And then he kicked heroin and was never addicted to heroin again. But apparently, you know, used cocaine and other drugs, alcohol and other things off and on throughout his life. And you know, went into some really dark periods. There's a period from 1975 to 1981 where he did not play at all. He did not even pick up his horn. He did not perform. He didn't record. He just went into a dark, as he puts it, a dark, dark hole. So we try to deal with that.
Yeah. Did you ever see him in live performance or meet him? Or?
I did see Miles a couple times live. I did go to a show where he didn't show up.
You know? Really?
Yeah. I think there was some problem with his equipment arriving from wherever, some, you know, Japan or somewhere, and he just refused to go on with anybody else's equipment without his own equipment, and just the band just didn't play. So that was Miles. I did see Miles, and then sometimes he was great, and you know, he did as every he was famous for, kind of turned his back on the audience and just played.
Diving into the subject matter for this film, is there something you found out that you didn't know, or some piece of music that you really developed a new appreciation for?
Well, I mean, I think one of the most important things in this film is that we use Miles's voice. We take his autobiography and we have an actor, you know, kind of read, but be Miles. So the film is kind of narrated by Miles through his own life, and you get an idea of what Miles was feeling, you know, at various times in his life. And I think that's something really new and a different way to look at Miles.
Yeah, and I mean, he's always reinventing himself, and you show that throughout the film with the different incarnations of his bands, especially that the 80s stuff that you have in the end of the film. I mean, it's like, wow, is that really Miles Davis doing those? Can you talk a little bit about that period? What did you learn about that period in his life?
Yeah, I mean, again, one of the things we wanted to do was make sure that that we talked about that period, because there's so many people like, ah, the 70s and 80s, ah, that was crap. But, you know, but, you know, it wasn't. I mean, Miles basically invented the whole idea of jazz fusion, you know, where he sees that rock music is taking over, you know, Sly and the Family Stone and Jimi Hendrix. And he says, well, you know, I could do that too. And so he comes out, you know, with Bitches Brew, which was at that point the fastest selling jazz album in history. And he kind of just makes a complete turn. And when you see the footage, because now we're in the era where there is film and is video, you know, it's hard to believe that it's the same guy who's playing Kind of Blue and Sketches of Spain. You know, there's one scene that I love where he goes to a Indian restaurant with Mtume, the drummer, and he tells Mtume, well, did you hear, what'd you think? And Mtume's like, what, the food? It was good. And Miles says, no, the music that they were playing. Would you like the music? Because that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to mix a tabla and sitar with funk. You know?
Sure, that's going
to
work.
And then we cut to that group, which is just one of the wildest group ever, which, you know, had a tabla player in the front and Miles and a sitar player and all of that going on at once.
And some of the interviews, I noticed you got a lot of his old friends together, right, which was really nice to see those and the book ending of the film with those. Can you talk a little bit about the family itself, like his kids and the interviews you got there? Were those tough or were they hard to cut into? Or
You know, not really. I mean, you know, so in the film is his daughter Cheryl, his youngest son Aaron, and his nephew Vince. No, they weren't hard. You know, Cheryl's kind of shy, does not like to be interviewed, but she did agree to an interview finally, and so it was great to get her, you know, and get her in the film. And I think that you know, Aaron and Vince added another dimension, especially when they talk about Miles during the hiatus, what's called the hiatus, 75 to 81, because they were there. And they saw Miles, and they were, but they were teenagers, you know, and young. And to see Miles, you know, that young, you know, in this kind of really, you know, awful down period is really fascinating for us.
I mean, it really is the roller coaster ride of his life, and the way that you put it on film is great that you had so much footage and these interviews that you were able to get. And,
yeah. I mean, we're very, very, very lucky. I mean, you know, one thing that I think, you know, colors the whole film where we start is that, you know, Miles grew up in East St. Louis, but his father was a dentist, and Miles grew up, you know, really wealthy. I mean, that's how he grew up. You know, so, you know, Miles grew up with his father had a horse farm, and Miles grew up with a horse, you know, so that was how Miles grew up.
Yeah, that's something I learned I didn't know.
Yeah.
It's a great learning experience, this film.
Well, to wrap up, there's one thing I wanted to ask you. When is somebody going to put together the Stanley Nelson compendium of all the is there all the films, you know?
Yeah,
huge box set.
We're trying to do that. One of the things that's happened, unfortunately, is that, you know, in just the financing of the film, we've had to get a 10-year limit on some of the rights to some of the footage and the still pictures. So we're working on trying to up those rights so we have those in perpetuity. And at that point, we're hoping to put all the films together and make them available for people. And also, you know, in different ways. So there'll be a civil rights, you know, box set or whatever.
I mean, they should selling them at those at the fundraisers. A lot more attractive than the tote bag, you know, I tell you. But your debut is for the film is today at 8:30 over at Prospector Square, and then back again Wednesday 8:30 a.m. at the Egyptian, and Friday, February 1st at the Mark Theater at 2:30, and then on Saturday the 2nd you're down in Salt Lake. But again, a veteran of this festival, so nice to see you back here. Wow. Stanley Nelson.
Great to see you. Thank you so much. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Claudia McMullen, founder of Hugo Coffee Roasters. At Hugo Coffee, we love two things, coffee and dogs, and not necessarily in that order. Part of Hugo Coffee's mission is to save rescue animals in our community. That is why we love sponsoring the KPCW Nuzzles & Co. Adoptable Moment during the KPCW Classified Show. Hugo Coffee, saving dogs, one cup at a time.
Do you love music as much as I do? Hi, I'm Christy Dilloway, music consultant to KPCW and a groupie for Great Grooves. I listen to music all the time, looking for the best new tracks for you, adding them to the KPCW playlist to debut as fresh tracks on Fridays. When you hear a fresh track, let me know. Do you love it? Do you hate it? Should it stay or should it go? Post a comment on the KPCW Radio Facebook page, hashtag fresh tracks, or email Christy at kpcw.org. Together, we'll keep the KPCW playlist fresh.
Welcome back to the Sundance Reel on the Weekends. In studio with us now is Ross Kaufman. He is an Academy Award-winning director of the documentary Born into Brothels. His professional accomplishments as a director, producer, cinematographer, editor span almost 30 years. In 2014, Kaufman co-directed The E-Team, a documentary which debuted at the Sundance Film Festival and garnered a U.S. Documentary Cinematography Award. And Kaufman recently completed his first script short, Boy, Boy, Girl, Girl, starring Kate Holmes. And this year in the U.S. doc competition is Tigerland. It's the story of a family in India that is working passionately to save some of the last tigers in Asia. Welcome to KPCW, Ross.
Thank you very much.
Coming back to Sundance, any thoughts about just being back here?
I just love it.
Yeah,
I mean everyone loves it here.
Of course,
it's incredible. This is like family here.
Yeah. And this film, do you have a personal connection to why you told this story, or is it just a big Tiger fan? Or
yeah, I mean, well, first of all, one thing I did find out, you know, when you start doing a film. And, you know, all right, we're doing a film about tigers. Tigers are everywhere. All of a sudden, you know, I see tigers all over the place. Everyone loves tigers all of a sudden. It's really, like, people's favorite animal.
And Frank Stallone's Eye of the Tiger just kept popping on the radio every time you were doing something?
Yeah, yes, it did for a while.
And the Siberian tiger, just to make sure I understand correctly, these are white tigers, is that right?
No, Siberian tigers are not white tigers.
What is the look in terms of, do they look like your typical tiger?
Well, Siberian tigers are the largest tiger. They're, you know, in the it's just like a cat, you know, in the winter, their fur just expands. Mm. And they're really incredibly looking, incredibly beautiful creatures.
Wow. And I mean, in filming this, I mean, you learned more about like what their life cycle was, or people are killing them. And how do we, you know, how do we learn this in your tale?
Yeah. You know, we for me, I was really curious about the tiger and, you know, about all the statistics and what's going on with them, you know, how much they're being poached. But the film is really about man's relationship with the tiger, and we just wanted to really get to know people who are passionate about saving the tiger. And in India, we followed a man named Kailash Sankla, who in the 50s and 60s and 70s, he was absolutely 100% dedicated to saving the tiger. And then we went to Russia, where we followed a man named Pavel Fomenko. And Pavel is this huge, hulking force. you know, your stereotypical Russian. But underneath, he's a, you know, pussycat. sorry about that.
No pun intended.
Low-hanging fruit.
But both of these men, they're divided by 50, they're separated by 50 years and thousands of miles. But their passion is really what brings them together.
I was just reading that they're down to 4,000 in existence. Is that right?
Yeah. Over the past century, they've been decimated by 95%. There were about 100,000 roaming the Tigerlands, and over the last century, they've been down.
I didn't get to see this, but is there hope?
There's absolutely
good?
Hope. Yeah, okay. There's absolutely hope. Part of the film came out of an initiative between Discovery and the World Wildlife Fund called Project CAT. Their mandate, their hope is to double the amount of tigers by 2022. And they're on their way.
Mm. And is that done through establishing conservation or sanctuary areas, or cutting legally, just cutting down on poaching and hunting, or both approaches?
Well, it started out as an initiative to preserve lands, about 1 million acres in India and Bhutan. So it started out with 1 million acres, then it quickly was raised to 2 million acres. And now, just this morning, it was announced that they are pledging to preserve another 3.7 million acres in Bikini National Park, which is where we filmed quite a bit of our film.
In the filming of this, I mean, was it just beautiful country that you'd never been to? Another bonus of going into this storyline? Or was it really hard to film here and you're like, oh, why did I choose this subject?
I often end up going to places where I say, why did I choose this? And where my wife says, why did you go here? From the brothels of Calcutta to Syria and Libya and E-Team, it's taken me to a lot of sort of crazy places. But this was, I mean, we were in some of the most beautiful places in the world. I went to Kanha National Park in India. Beautiful place. It was about 100 degrees when we were filming there. And then, you know, a month later, we're in the far east of Russia, where it was minus 20 degrees. But both places are absolutely gorgeous.
Do you have to exercise a certain amount of caution in terms of if you're filming the tigers? What are the guidelines for, you know, how close you can, you know, you can get to these beasts? You don't want to end up as, you know, the sequel to Grizzly Man or something. You don't want to end up like, you know, one of those guys.
We kept our distance, let's put it that way. But saying that, we actually got very close to tigers in India, very close up. And my cinematographer, Matt Porwal, and I, we really, really prepared ourselves to capture the tigers in the most cinematic way we could. But truthfully, when we went and we started this project, we expected not to see any tigers. Mm. It's really hard to see tigers in the wild. But we got very lucky.
They just really big snacks, or I mean, what do you think?
No, it's interesting. In India, I mean, it's all about information and being with people who know what they're doing. In India, we were with Kailash Sankla's grandson, Amit Sankla, and Amit is, you know, he knows everything about tigers, and he knew exactly when to go out, when to, you know, where to go. Even with that said, you don't know if you're going to see tigers, but, you know, with the right people, you know, you have at least a chance.
You get a much better chance than if you're just kind of taking a whole film crew out there.
Yeah, and the same in Russia with Pavel Fomenko. Pavel, he's an expert. He knows everything about tigers. He's been working with tigers for, I think, 25 years, maybe 30 years. I mean, at one point when we got to Russia, we didn't expect to, you know, we didn't know what we were going to run into or do. And the first afternoon that we met Pavel, he sort of mentioned offhandedly that, oh, we have to go and hunt for cubs tomorrow because their mother, the mother tigress, was eating dogs in the local village. We captured her. Now we have to find the cubs or they will die. So the next morning, Zan Parker, my producer, and I got up 4 a.m., put on our warm clothing, and went to this incredible place where they looked for tiger cubs. And that's all I'll say because I don't want to ruin the film at all.
Yeah. Well, there's some elements of the local population, India and Russia, who say, you know, what are you trying to save these animals? You know, kill our dogs or kill us if they've got the chance. You know, why are you preserving?
I mean, interestingly enough, the local populations actually want to save the tiger. Mm. They understand that the tiger is a very important part of saving their land. And if you save the tiger and you save the tiger's land, it helps out the local community. If you help out the local community, it also helps the forest. If you can save the forest, you save the water sources, and then that's going to help out humanity.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Great.
Okay, and you had the
What was the scariest, I mean, was there the scariest moment in filming this that you hit in India? I mean, was this something that just happened and you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we almost lost somebody or
anything close to that?
You know, on this film, everything was pretty safe. We were really taken care of. It's not like my previous films where there was some danger involved. I mean, the scariest part of this film is really just finding these stories and hoping that you're going to be able to tell them in a true and honest way. And we were very fortunate that we found great characters. Their stories were just playing out in front of us, and we were able to capture them.
Okay. Thank you. And you have your debut for Tigerland, according to our schedule, at noon today at the library. And let's see, later Monday night, 7 o'clock at Redstone, and Thursday, you're over at The Mark, Thursday, January 31st, on Friday down to Salt Lake, and finally, Saturday the 2nd, you're over at the Park Ave Theater at, again, 12 noon. So,
yes, yeah. Ross.
Yeah. I just wanted to say thank you on behalf of Discovery, the World Wildlife Fund, the Radical Media, and my whole crew. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Ross.
You're very welcome. Thank you. We'll see you next time.
Proud sponsor of KPCW, DeJoria Center looks forward to the upcoming events calendar with shows such as Bill Ingvall, Chris Jansen, Beauty and the Beast, and Slaughter. Tickets and information at DeJoriaCenter.com.
So there's probably a smart speaker in your home. I don't want to say her name because I don't want to turn her on without your permission. I am married after all. Did you know you could ask her to play KPCW? You can listen to great music, news, and information no matter where you are. As long as you have that smart speaker or KPCW app on your phone or your laptop where you can stream us online. KPCW Radio isn't limited by our broadcast signal in Summit and Wasatch County. You can take us wherever you are in the world and listen like a local.
And we're back with the Sundance Reel in the Morning for the Sunday edition. I'm Rick Bruff here with my co-host, John Burdick. And we've got in the studio the film Relive, which is in the premiere section, is with our writer-director, Jacob Estes.
Hi.
Yeah, so
welcome.
How do you... So yeah, and this is I know you've been here previously to Sundance. How many times now counting this?
This is my third time. Sure. Yeah, I was here in 2004 with my first film,
Mean Creek.
Yeah,
and have you all? I think on all the films you've been the writer director.
So, yes, that's right.
So yeah. The writer can't complain that the director's
screwing up the words. Right?
No, sometimes when I'm directing, I talk about the writer in third person as if he's an idiot, and I tell the actors that they don't have to pay attention to that dummy.
Yeah. How's that go over with your actors?
Oh, it's good because I don't think that the words tend to matter that much, and I try to like free myself from sticking to my words exactly because the fantasy that the writer has of what the actor is going to do is always shattered by the fact that you have a real human being who is not your fantasy in front of you, and you have to give in to that.
Uh-huh. That the when you were writing it, this particular line just sounded so much greater than the way this guy's doing it. Is that?
No. Usually the actor does the line so much better than I imagine it in my head. Yeah. So I try to divorce myself from the sort of initial imagination of how a line might be delivered and just try to listen to what's actually going on with the actor and what he's actually delivering. And that's usually a lot better than what I first imagined. Because usually I might imagine, like, you know, Jack Nicholson doing it at age 30. Instead, here I am working with David Oyelowo, you know, at a different point in history.
Yeah. Talk about the plot of this. It sounds like kind of a hybrid, and those films can be really interesting when you don't quite know.
It's not one category or another. It's
where the heck are you going?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the film essentially deals with a massive family trauma. David Oyelowo's detective in Los Angeles, and his brother is sort of a low-level drug dealer, just a decent guy who happens to get by. He's a musician, actually, and he happens to support himself dealing drugs, and not a bad guy, a good guy, a family man. And David kind of covers for him as a surrogate father for his niece, who's the character is Ashley, and she's played by Storm Reid. And this totally irreconcilable violence happens, where it appears that David's brother, who's played by Brian Tyree Henry, has killed his entire family and himself. And that's early on in the movie, and it's extremely devastating to David's character, and he's in the middle of a grieving cycle, and I think we've all kind of experienced this losses in our lives, whether our wives or some people, unfortunately, their children, and that's how it feels for David. And I know I've experienced loss like that, and there's this feeling that you get that you could reach through the fabric of, you should be able to reach through the fabric of the universe and pull them back somehow. And that's the premise of, you know, this is why we believe in ghosts and things. You know? We want to believe in those things. And this strange thing happens while David is grieving. He gets a phone call from his dead niece's cell phone number. And he doesn't even answer it because it's just so shocking to see. But he does dial back, and something even weirder happens, which is he gets a disconnect notice. So... he goes, he's a cop, he goes looking for the phone in the property room, and when he it's inappropriate for him to be handling state's evidence, but he puts it in his hand, and he's looking at this phone in his hand, and his own phone rings again from the other phone that's in his hand, which is dead. And he answers the phone, and he doesn't talk, but he hears his niece's voice. And he doesn't know if he's talking to a ghost or if he's going mad. And he doesn't talk, and she hangs up on him because he's not talking. And he doesn't know what that is. But it's really a profound experience for him. And then she calls again. Mm. And the movie is a series of phone calls. And eventually... he discovers that he's talking to a living person, but before she died. Mm. And there's no explanation for why she's calling ever in the whole film.
Mm. Kind of that open-ended mystery that you leave out there for people to figure out.
Yeah, and it presents an opportunity for him to start interrogating her and activating her to do things in her own timeline to help him understand what actually happened to his brother, which of course creates a butterfly effect.
if she draws
something on a wall in her reality, suddenly his reality shifts.
David, have you worked with David before? Did you imagine him when you were writing the character? How did he get involved with the project?
No, the casting process was fairly unique, I guess. It was really written for a white guy in a farmhouse in the Midwest, and I was out scouting farmhouses in the Midwest. And the reason the movie took place in a remote farmhouse was because there was this series of gunshots that went off as a plot point. Nobody called the police because nobody heard them, and that was an important plot point. But the movie has nothing to do with identity or racial identity or anything like that, and I always felt that the movie could be cast with the best actor, whoever that was. because the movie was about family and shattering family and trying to reach out and find your family again. And David read the script because on a lark, I thought maybe this great actor who I wanted to work with ever since I saw him the first time. And I think it was The Last King of Scotland, and I waited for the credits to roll to see who that was. And ever since then, I've hoped to work with him. And he wanted to meet, so I left the Midwest where I was scouting farmhouses and sat down with him. And he said he loved the script, and I said I loved him. And he said, could we shoot it in L.A.? Because he wanted to be around his family, and I had never even thought of that. And I said, well, I don't picture you as a farmer out in the Midwest, but how are we going to reconcile the issue of the gunshots that go off in this house and nobody calls the police? And together we hatched the idea that it could take place in a community like Watts or South
Compton
Central.
Or something.
Yeah, something like that, where maybe some gunshots went off and nobody wanted to call the police. And I live in a Echo Park in Los Angeles, and I know South Central Los Angeles exists. But I've seen it in movies and TVs, and it's been represented in a certain way. So I just decided to get in my car and start scouting, because I wanted to make sure that I felt comfortable shooting it in LA. And I got to look at Los Angeles from a completely different perspective, literally, just the way that the city looks from a different area in the city, looking at all the buildings from a different area in the city. And I felt like it was a perfect place to shoot the movie, because the movie's about family, and what I saw in South Central Los Angeles were a lot of houses with lawns and dogs and families and ice cream trucks going by. And you know, there's another part of that community too, of, you know, Western Avenue is full of prostitutes and difficult things. And but by and large, it just was this vibrant community. And I got very excited to shoot the movie there. And we cast a family of people around David Oyelowo. And that's how that works.
That's kind of fun, where you are the writer or the director, and you can make that kind of change. And it seems like this is such a collaborative process that getting him involved completely changed the way in which you filmed this, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Did it become more of a police procedural when you shifted to L.A., or was it always there in that Midwest story?
It was always a police procedural, you know, but it was going to be a small-town police procedural, and it turned into an LAPD police procedural. So we had to build a LAPD police station.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Jacob Estes from Relive. It premieres right now, today at 8:45 at the Mark. And then Tuesday, the 29th, at the Eccles Center in the morning, February 1st, at the Grand Theater in Salt Lake, and Park Avenue on the 2nd, as well as the Sundance Mountain Screening Room on the 3rd. Thank you so much for coming into the Sundance Reel on the weekend.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay.